and I'm your host on this program, Ijaz Hussain. Once again, I'm joined by my good friend and expert guest, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, on this program. I'd like to say salam to him and welcome him to this program.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you very much, sir, for being with us once again and accepting our invitation. Sir, we are going to speak about unity. Mm-hmm. And of course, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul. I remember some very beautiful things that he was saying about, you know, the unity of the ummah. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about, you know, not being Sunni or Shia, but being Muslim. And, you know, going to each other's mosques and being with each other, praying with each other. We even see that in Iraq even today, that they're, you know, because of the violence from the Takfiris, we even see the Sunnis and Shias now even praying together and being martyred together.
Exactly.
In the mosques, you know, these horrible car bombs that go off in Baghdad. You know, we are seeing that all the time, these horrific scenes where Muslims are being slaughtered during prayer, which, you know, leaves one, you know, wondering, you know, exactly, you know, what's going on. But the Imam, as I say, may God bless his great soul, emphasized this unity a great deal. And we see the need for this unity every day and every moment. So, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, without further ado, I leave the stage entirely to you to give us your take on that.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what you mentioned is exactly, you know, the important point, which is that you have an Islamic leader with all those things that we've talked about so many times and
That's right.
Those important matters, both religiously and also politically and globally. And one of his main points and one of the things that he emphasizes repeatedly is Islamic unity.
Yes.
Now, this is a man who is a, as we've mentioned many times before, a clergy and a scholar and somebody who is completely and 100% coming out of the school of Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
So one might think, if one doesn't really know the school of Ahlul Bayt, or if one doesn't know a person like
Very
Imam.
Very good point, yes.
Well, he should be, you know, a prime candidate for, you know, causing problems.
Causing problems, yes. And, as we've seen in other traditions.
And,
yes.
You know, being very hostile towards other Islamic denominations.
True.
And yet,
he didn't do that.
He does the opposite of that. He calls for Islamic unity.
Wonderful.
Because there's two aspects of that.
Please.
Of what he did. This is my analysis of it. Of course, sure. I'm sure there might be other analyses of why he was doing it. My analysis is that one was that it came out of the school of Ahlul Bayt, because we see that during the time of the presence of the imams,
excellent,
they never try to
divide
the ummah.
They never did.
That even in the worst conditions, even when the khulafa were killing them and their families,
that's right,
they tried to maintain
the unity of the ummah.
Okay?
Very good.
And they realized that this is of, you know, supreme importance.
Of course.
And there's no point in, you know, the ummah breaking up and, you know, different denominations
or different groups
fighting each other and setting up rival this and that.
No.
So it comes directly as everything with Imam.
Sure.
Out of the example and the sunnah of the Prophet and, you know, the Imams.
Sure.
Of maintaining, you know, that unity. The second aspect of it is really this complete and total political astuteness and cleverness that Imam always had.
Yes. The wisdom that we were talking about
before. Complete, and I'm talking about politically.
Yes.
You know, I mean, he had the greater wisdom, but he was also an extremely clever politician in terms of understanding tactically and strategically what needs to be done at what point.
Point, yes.
I would just want to make a little reference to another subject just to prove my bigger point.
Please do, yes.
Many people at the time of the revolution were insisting that the imperial army, that the Iranian army, that was part of the Shah's regime, should be dissolved.
Right.
And Imam stood firm like a rock, saying it will not be dissolved. And that many of the soldiers and many of the officers are not part of the Shah's thinking and, you know, weren't killing people. And that this would be a great catastrophe for the country.
If
we dissolve the army. Mm. Not only that, he even wrote letters and spoke to the officers and said, you are part of us. You are, you know, you are our children. We're together in this. You know, you can be your own boss.
Wonderful.
This wasn't, you know, you don't need the American advisors. You yourself have the capabilities. Mm-hmm. And many people in the army at that time were actually quite religious. So this was a, you know, they were trying to portray this image as the army being like the army of Turkey or Egypt, which is completely
irreligious. Yeah, but they had religious sympathies.
But most of the members of the army, whether it was Air Force or Army, the ground troops, or whether it was even the Navy, had religious backgrounds. And Imam knew this.
Ah.
And he was very clever in not doing this, because at that time you had many of these, you know, later we turned out like the, you know, these terrorists that are now, you know, going to...
Yes, you're referring to the MKO, aren't you?
Right.
Yeah.
These terrorists that, alhamdulillah, thank God, no longer
exist now.
They were pressing Imam at that time, oh, dissolve the army, we will be the new army.
Sure.
And can you imagine if that would have happened?
Oh, my God.
Right? So this is part of the cleverness.
Yes.
The other part of the cleverness of Imam was, again, as we've talked about many times, understanding who the real and the main enemy is.
Yes.
The real and the main enemy at that time are and is America and Israel.
That's right.
And one of the ways in which they cause trouble is by
dividing
the Muslims.
Yes.
Sunni Shia.
Creating, you know, tensions amongst the Muslims.
Inter Shia, inter Sunni, Takfiri, this, that, whatever.
Sure.
And so when Imam, as this religious man that he is, as this person who is a complete, you know, representative and leader of the Shias, comes out and he forcefully talks about unity and Islamic unity.
Sure.
And not only does that in terms of his speech, but also does it in action.
In action, yes.
We see that when the Islamic Republic of Iran is established, where in the constitution it is mentioned that the official religion is the Ja'fari madhab, where we talk about all the basis of the law being the Ja'fari law. And yet we also see that it is also a time where there's a renaissance of the Sunni population.
That's
and
right.
Areas that they live, in the sense that they are allowed to and they practice their own madhab. They have their own courts, they have their own, you know, systems in terms of their personal law.
You sure?
Okay. They're not governed in personal law by the Ja'fari law. And they have representatives and they're
in the parliament, yes.
You know, they're part of the normal structure of the society.
Society, yes.
And
along with other minorities.
And yes,
as
there
well.
Might have been from history and, you know, historically speaking, some deprivations in some of the areas because they do live in marginal areas, for example, in the West or in the East. So
sure.
That's a different issue that has, you know, actually very little to do with their denomination, more of a geographic and historic issue.
Yes.
But in terms of them being able to live in this Islamic Republic in a dignified way, nobody doubts that. And sure. They themselves are the best, you know, testament of that. And you know, you see what happened over the generation, the last 2-3 generations. You really see a marked improvement. And you know, many of the areas, especially if you look at the southeast in Sistan Baluchistan, you really had very high illiteracy rates before the revolution. And now literally everyone, there's schools, there's literacy, there's, you know, development in a way that was, you know, unimaginable years ago.
Sure.
All of it, you know, under the rule of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is based on the Imami school of Islam. So even within Iran, and you know, they always try to bring in like side issues, like, oh, there, you know, in Tehran there is no, you know, Imam, you know, they don't have the Friday prayers for the Sunnis. Well, you know, you go in most of the cities where the Sunnis are the majority, you have Friday prayers which are you know, headed by the by the Sunni denomination. And the Shias go there and, you know, there's joint prayers, like you were saying.
Sure.
And, you know, these are not things that, you know, if people want to cause trouble, they can always find reasons to do that. But the reality is completely different.
Yes.
This is on the national level. On the international level, we see that Imam immediately talks about, you know, supporting, for example, the Palestinians. Well,
That's true.
We always say, are the Palestinians Shia or Sunni?
They're Sunni.
Well, they're Sunni.
Yes.
Okay? We're talking about, you know, Imam from the very beginning not allowing this, you know, evil cancer, whatever you want to call it, to seep into the minds of people. And unfortunately what we see, and this brings us to the situation we're currently in, and all the things we've discussed in terms of Syria and, you know, Ali Saud and Takfiris and so on, we see that, unfortunately, from the beginning, as it was during the time of the British, the main tool for causing division within the Muslim world are the Ahl al-Saud and the Takfiris.
Exactly.
By how? By declaring everybody else to be kafir.
Yes. Non-believers.
Non-believers. Every other Muslim except for us, according to them, yes, is a non-believer. That's why, because you were mentioning, you know, being bombed during prayer.
Sure.
Which Muslim would kill another Muslim during prayer?
During prayer. Exactly.
I mean, this is horrendous. It's completely reprehensible. I mean, this is something no Muslim would do. Another Muslim.
No.
I mean, imagine, you know, family feud, arguments, you know, theological disputes.
Sure.
Well, you know, one of the red lines of, you know, where you don't go is you don't kill people during prayer.
Exactly. But they crossed it.
Okay.
The Takfiris have crossed it.
So, you know, this is bad.
This is really bad.
Bad in the sense that, you know, you have now a legion of monsters, of shayateen, you know, with big beards and, you know.
Yes.
Whatever.
Yeah.
You know, they have the shape of, and it's actually, you know what? It's actually, I would like to say it this way. They don't even look, they're a caricature of Islam.
Yes, they're a caricature of Islam. You're
okay.
Right.
Okay. Yes. I mean, we have a tradition of having beards. You know, I have a beard. Right?
Yes.
You know, the ulama, they usually have longer beards or whatever. I mean, this is part of the sunnah of the Prophet and you know. So there's nothing wrong with having a beard.
Yeah.
But I mean, you just look at these guys and they're caricatures.
Yes.
They don't look normal.
No.
They don't, you know, there's something wrong with them.
Something wrong with them, yes.
You know, when we say extremist, you could just tell they're like...
There's something psychopathic about them, yes.
So we don't even have them, because I was going to say we have these people who are supposedly the representatives of Islam or they look Muslim. They actually don't really look Muslim.
No.
They look like a caricature of Islam.
Islam, yes.
Literally.
Literally, yes.
And they are portrayed as being, you know, the representative of Islam. Mm. You see in Syria, I mean, it's nuts. I mean, look at what they did in Syria.
I know, it's horrendous.
And the ones that are funding the whole thing and wanting these guys to be the representative of Islam in the world and to wipe out everybody else are the Ahl al-Saud.
Yes.
And the reason the Ahl al-Saud want this is not because they have some sort of a deep attachment to the, you know, and love for, you know, Abdul Wahhab, you know, or Ibn Taymiyyah or one of these guys who is supposedly the quote-unquote scholars of the Takfiris,
yes,
right? Because you can't even call them scholars.
Scholars, no, right. You can't.
You can't really call them scholars.
No.
It's not that. It's not because they are, you know, holding up the flag of you know, pure Salaf Islam.
Yeah.
Because Salaf Islam doesn't kill other Muslims.
No, it doesn't.
Right?
No.
So it's really about using these and exploiting these ignorant people in order to stay in power.
Exactly.
In Saudi Arabia, in order to have control over the oil fields,
sure,
which is, you know, billions and billions, in order to have control over Mecca and Medina, which is billions and billions.
Billions, yes.
And this is all it's about.
Yes.
You know, neither King Abdullah nor any of the other, you know.
No, it's all about money and
old
power.
Guys and, you know, brothers and half-brothers and cousins and uncles. None of those guys care about, you know, pure Islam.
No, they don't. They care about power and money.
They care about Ahl al-Saud staying in power, and they will do whatever it takes to do that. And if it takes them, you know, unleashing, you know, a legion of wacko, you know, terrorist organ eaters and, you know, cannibals and heart eaters.
Yes.
And, you know, people who will cut off heads with... I'm purposely mentioning the things they're doing. So
yes,
people
exactly.
realize what they're doing. I apologize.
They literally sawed the heads off.
They didn't saw them. No, brother. They didn't saw them. They used kitchen knives. Okay? And, you know, going around, for example, cutting the heads off priests.
Yes.
You know in Islam horrible. And in the Quran what it says?
Yes, I know.
Which says we have to protect the churches.
Yes, we have to protect the people of the book.
We have all the rivayat that talk about, you know, us, you know.
We are not allowed to touch
this
them,
is not,
violate
they are
them
not
in any
kafir.
Shape or form.
They're not kafir in the sense of being
no,
kafir
they're
harbi.
Not.
They're not. We're not in war against them. They're living under the protection of Islam and Muslims. You're not allowed to do this, you crazy person.
Mm.
You have to respect them. And yet they do it.
They do it. So that shows the real evil nature.
It shows that they are not Muslim. They don't understand Islam.
No,
they don't know the Quran. They
no.
don't know anything.
No, they don't.
Okay? They're just there to
create
help
chaos.
The Saudis and the Israelis cause division amongst them.
Exactly.
So having said all that,
yes,
we get to the current times. Well, we see that the Supreme Leader, may God protect him.
Yes, please.
Continuing the line of Imam. Talking about that we have to maintain Islamic unity So many years now, he's been talking about Islamic unity. At a time when others weren't even talking about it, he was talking about that we should have Islamic unity.
Sure, yes.
He's talking about the fact that this division, Sunni-Shia divisions, are the making of the enemies of Islam. And it's very interesting. Again, you have a person like the Supreme Leader, again, Ayatollah Khamenei, you know, a leader of the Shias. He's from the, you know, Imami school. And he talks about that it's takfiris, mainly on the so-called, he says they call themselves Sunni, but they're not Sunni. And then he says there's even some on the Shia side.
Yes.
He talks about them.
This kind of extremism and takfirism, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah,
from the Shia side.
Coming from the Shia side and condemning it.
Yes.
And not only condemning it, but issuing the fatwas that are required to condemn it.
Talking about
not cursing, you know, the personalities that are important to the different denominations.
Exactly.
Talking about unity, okay?
Sure.
So it's not simply, you know, rhetoric. It's actually action.
No. It's also education, isn't it, as well? Because he's educating us as how to be brothers with one another.
Exactly. Because this is what Islam is.
Exactly. Okay. That's what it's all about.
Right. Mm. And the point is simply this. The differences that we might have pale in comparison to the dangers we face from the enemies.
And the enemy, yes, that's true.
Okay?
Yeah.
This is the point.
Mm.
Nobody is trying to, you know, compromise on our deep-held beliefs. And, you know, everybody knows how much we love the Ahlul Bayt and how much we consider them to be the way in
which... The best examples for us to follow.
And the way in which we can, you know, get close to God.
Close to God and understand Islam, of
Because
course.
They are the ones that teach us real Islam.
Yes.
Okay? They're the ones that tell us, you know, the this is our basic belief as Imami Muslims.
Absolutely.
Is that we have Thaqalain, we have Quran, and we have Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
And they're together.
They're together, yes.
Okay, and if you don't have one, then you don't have Islam.
Exactly.
So if you don't have Quran, but you have Ahlul Bayt, you don't have Islam. If you have Ahlul Bayt and you don't have Quran, you don't have Islam.
Exactly.
So, you know, this is our belief. So nobody's trying to compromise on that or trying to, step
back. No, that's not what it's
about. But you have to look at the same Ahlul Bayt and how they behaved.
Exactly.
Number
That's
one.
The point.
Number
yes.
two, you have to also be clever.
Mm.
And you have to understand who the real enemy is.
Yes.
And so this is why, because then people might say, well, you always keep going on about Ali Saud and, you know, Takfiris, and, well, aren't you doing exactly that? Well, our point in all these is that they are one of the greatest barriers to Islamic unity.
This is the problem.
Because they are neither Sunni nor Shia.
No. They are the enemies of
They're
Islam.
They're not a denomination of Islam.
The enemies of
they
Allah.
They look like, you know, they are Islamic, although, they look like caricatures of Islam. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not about, you know, well, why, if you're saying all this and then you're going ending up attacking the takfiris. Well, the takfiris don't even consider us Muslim, so why should we?
Yeah, exactly. You know? I mean, this is the point. Yes.
So we don't consider them to really be Muslim.
No.
Because no Muslim does these things. It's not simply about saying it with your tongue.
No,
it's not about just, you know, saying shahadatain.
No, it's all on video. It's all on the internet.
It's not just about saying shahadatain.
No.
Okay, so you say shahadatain and then you end up doing everything which is against, you know, the most basic principles of Islam. How can you say that that person is a Muslim?
Exactly.
Just because they have a beard?
Sure.
Just because they say Allahu Akbar?
No, I mean, the thing is, this is what I was saying in one program myself on this subject, on the very subject of takfiris. I was suggesting that, you know, I mean, we're talking about democracy and talking about systems of government that give quality of life, progression to its people. But what are we going to get with if the takfiris are in power? We have to eat the liver of our neighbors? I mean, is that the way we're going to carry
well,
on from
Well, I think
now
this is what has become so painfully clear in Syria.
Yeah.
Is they were trying to portray this as, you know, the Sunni masses rising up against the evil Alawi dictatorship and the Shia dictatorship.
Sure.
And the majority of Sunnis were like, hey, wait a second. You know, we don't want to be...
With them.
No, we're not with them.
No, no.
Okay?
Because I don't want to eat my neighbor
This
tomorrow.
Is not what Sunni Islam is.
Yes.
Okay? Mm. This is a problem that we've had over the last 100 years, is that these takfiris and these so-called Salafis and Wahhabis, and, you know, there's even distinctions between them.
Them as well, yes, true.
Right? Within them, there's even different grades and shades, right?
Sure.
But let's just call it Wahhabis and takfiris. Mm. The problem we've had is they were successful in claiming that they're Sunnis, and yet they're not Sunnis.
No.
They don't speak for the Sunnis.
No, they don't.
And it has to do with the fact that many of the Sunnis in the last 100 years were at a very low level of understanding of religion.
Yes.
In terms of literacy, and it has to go with the civilizational decline that existed in the Muslim world.
That's right.
It has to do with the fact that you had imperial powers coming in. You really didn't have good teachers of Islam.
No.
I'm not saying there were none, there were some, but the level was low. And so when you had this funding and this movement coming out of Saudi Arabia with all that oil money and
they managed to take that over.
Support by the Americans and the British, they were able to
hijack
a lot of the a lot of the Sunni mosques and centers and so on.
You know, even this al-Nusra front at the moment in Syria, you know, who are the caricatures of Islam, as you described it, even they're killing each other, you know, even in within their own groupings as well, that even that there are several groups that are supposed to be in the Free Syrian Army, but it's neither free nor Syrian.
Nor an army.
And they're killing all, you know, each other as well.
Right.
So, I mean, what, that's the thing. What are you going to get at the end of the day?
It's a dead end.
It is a dead end.
You know, this is because there's no reality, you know, as the basis of it. This is why you have the movements that happened, for example, in Iran, or you have movements such as Hezbollah, which happened in Lebanon, you know, being successful in the long run because they're based on reality. They're based on truth.
They're based on truth, yes.
They're based on Islam, which is according to the Quran, according to the Sunnah. The
principles of the Quran, okay? Yes, absolutely.
And these takfiris are not according to the Quran and the Sunnah. They are the opposite of the Quran and Sunnah.
Exactly.
And believe me, this is the important point, and I really hope that the listeners, you know, can take this away from what we're saying.
Thank you for that.
When we say that the takfiris are not based on Islam, that doesn't mean we're saying they're not Sunnis.
No.
Because if you look at Sunnis, the four madhahib, the different scholars, you know, they have a lot of, you know, the basis is Quran, the basis is the hadith and the rivayat that have been exist in that school.
Sure.
And they're much closer to the reality of Islam than anything, you know, comparable to it. So don't be fooled. Don't let them say that we are Sunnis. Takfiris are not Sunnis.
No.
Okay?
No.
On the other hand, and I would want to emphasize this, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we have some, and I will clearly say it, mercenaries, some people who are paid by the Americans and the British, who put on, you know, Shia clothing, and they have Shia names, and they have Shia programs on TV and on satellite stations. Mm. And they are just as bad as these takfiris, because their takfiris in the other direction.
Yes, right.
Now, of course, they don't send, you know, armies into Syria to cut out the hearts of
people.
But
it's very damaging.
They're part of the same plan and game.
Game.
You have these extremists on this side trying to provoke and trying to, you know, going into Shia towns, for example, and killing, you know, kids and women and whatever, you know, desecrating graves. I mean, what Muslim would go and, you know, break open the grave of a Sahaba of the Prophet?
Prophet. I mean, this is ridiculous.
Why would you do that?
Yeah.
So who cares if he was friends with Ali or not? He's Sahaba of the Prophet.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Exactly. Why would you do that?
Mm.
What Muslim would do that? Okay.
No, it's unthinkable.
So that's then you have on the other side, you have the Shia mercenaries, the so-called whatever, the Takfiri Shias, you know,
right,
stoking the flames
of division,
right? Yeah. Saying, oh, this is this, and calling people
and
names.
Cursing and swearing for no reason.
Right.
Yeah. Mm. Which is forbidden in Islam.
Against the fatwa of all the Maraji.
Al Maraji, yes.
Okay.
We're not allowed to do that.
When the things were getting out of hand in Iraq, they asked Ayatollah Sistani, may God protect him. He said, you know, they asked him, are the Sunnis our brothers? And he said, they're not only not your brothers, they're your heart and soul.
My God.
This is what he told his followers. He said, they're not only your brothers, they're your heart and soul. You have to sacrifice yourself for them.
For them.
This is the school of Ahlul Bayt.
Exactly.
Okay? And people are seeing it.
Mm.
People are seeing this. I'm talking about the Sunnis.
Yes.
I'm talking about the majority of Sunnis. I'm talking about the Arabs, you know, of the different, whether it's Sunnis or Christians. Right. They're seeing what the reality is.
Sure.
They're not getting fooled by the Saudis and by their, you know, crazy
their vicious
preachers
propaganda,
and,
yes.
And, you know,
yes.
All these guys who come on TV and just spew hate and
yeah,
and division.
It is. They're spewing
and just
hatred,
remember
yes.
this, after all is said and done, who benefits? Who benefits?
Israel.
And it's clear that Israel and America and the enemies of Islam benefit from
of
these divisions.
There's
so why would you
international community? Isn't
why
it?
Why yeah. would you why would you do something that benefits Israel and America?
Exactly.
Against your fellow Muslim.
Exactly.
Why would you do that?
Mm.
So alhamdulillah, these things are being said.
Yes, exposed.
Alhamdulillah, the majority of brothers and sisters
are beginning to see
of
now
different, of different
yeah, the reality.
They're also seeing the reality of Shias, that the Shias are not, you know, these extremists, that
no.
they are, you know, mushrik, whatever,
no.
all the
And lies. That Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, was quite right about what he was saying at that, you know, 35 years
right.
ago, that this is going to be
because,
a major
because
problem.
Because we've shown with our action in the last 35 years, what we say, we also deliver with our action. We stick to our friends. We are not extremists. We want everybody to live peacefully.
Sure.
We don't discriminate based on denomination. And this is the way of Ahlul Bayt. This is the way of Imam Ali alayhi salam. This is the way of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. This is the way of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Absolutely.
Okay?
Absolutely.
This is who we follow because they are the ones that teach us real Islam. And it's good. I'm happy because things are moving in this direction.
That's right.
And the key is going to be the Arab populations. Mm. This is why the Saudis are freaking out.
Freaking out.
They're freaking out.
Even with the Muslim Brotherhood, in spite of all the mistakes they were making, they couldn't even tolerate them because they knew that what big a threat this is to their power.
It all comes down to the Arab populations being, you know, becoming familiar with real Islam.
Yes.
Looking at the real Sunnah of the Prophet.
That's right.
Looking at you know, great Arab personalities and leaders, the greatest Arab ever, Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Islam, of course,
right?
Of course.
Right? So this is not something that, you know...
Very nicely put.
It's their own heritage.
It is their own heritage.
It's their own. It's
excellent,
not like some
point.
Ajami,
yes.
Whatever, Majusi
no, it's their
thing
heritage.
Being... You know, when we're talking about Imam Ali alayhi salam, we're talking about, you know... We're talking about the noblest of noble Arabs.
Arabs.
You know?
My God.
Bani Hashim,
exactly.
Okay? So, you know, this is something that, you know, alhamdulillah, through the efforts of media to a certain extent, through the realities that people have seen
on the ground, yes.
The way Iran has behaved, the way, for example, the successes that Hezbollah has had, the changes that have occurred in Iraq.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
People are waking up. Mm. And this is why the Saudis are completely freaking out. This is why the Israelis are completely freaking out.
Yes.
Because they know that once the Arabs... or become familiar with
the true teachings of Islam.
The school of Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
And again, please, let me be very clear about this. It's not about labels.
No.
And we're not talking about people becoming Shia. It's not about that.
No, it's not about a conversion business.
It's about, you know, call yourself whatever you want.
Yes.
Just look at the teaching of Ahlul Bayt.
Right, and learn about Islam.
And you will see that this is with fitrah. This is your fitrah.
Exactly.
If you read Nahjul Balagha, if you read Saif-e Sajjadiyya by Imam Sajjad, alayhi salam, Imam Sajjad, Saif-e Sajjadiyya is a miracle.
Mm.
It's an amazing thing. It's an
it
amazing
is.
Thing.
Of course.
And if you're Arab and you understand Arabic, you know, it will immediately touch your heart. You will understand that this person is not a normal person, that this person is the one that's following and continuing the tradition of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and is the successor of the Prophet.
And trying to lead us towards perfection.
I'm talking about Imam Sajjad
and
Saif-e Sajjadiyya and the prayers that are in there
and
the way he talks to God.
Mm.
Okay? Anybody who has a heart... Anybody who is a little bit sincere, if you read Saif-e Sajjadiyya, how can you not be moved by it?
Exactly.
How can you be not by touched by it as a Muslim? So this is my message, is that don't be fooled.
Mm.
Takfiris are not Sunnis. It's not about labels. It's about following real Islam.
Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, on that note, I'd like to thank you for your valuable contribution on the program today. I hope our listeners have benefited from what you've said today. Thank you very much for that. And for our listeners, it just leaves me to say, Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Disasters that threaten the population of the Gaza Strip.
How's your work? What have you accomplished? Not much. We stopped the construction of the house because of the construction materials crisis in the Gaza Strip. There are no construction materials available, no cement, no steel, and no whitewash. Most construction materials stopped entering the strip due to the Egyptian army's military operations in the Sinai. In addition, they have already destroyed most of the tunnels between Egypt and Gaza, through which all materials used to enter. Now they have disappeared from the local market. On the other hand, Israel has been blocking all crossings to the Gaza Strip for 7 years.
When we decided to expose the problem of unemployment in the Gaza Strip, we were confused about a starting point. But we met with an informative colleague, Mr. Atif Isa, who paved the way for us. He told us about his suffering over 7 years in building his dream house, which is still under construction at the moment. According to his plan, it was supposed to be done 5 years ago.
According to my house plan, the house is supposed to be ready now, and I would have moved into it. But as you can see, it seems to be ready from the outside, but work still needs to be done. These days, I am supposed to have at least 5 or 6 teams working at the same time. These teams provide job opportunities to about 30 or 40 workers. That means there are 30 to 40 families that used to have income, but not anymore because I have stopped the building of my house. I'm the head of a family of 6 people. All I want is a job opportunity, and everything will go fine with me. I wish other workers could work too, like the old days of working in a team. There were supposed to be more than 20 workers working on this scaffolding. However, there are only 2 or 3 people because of the shortage in construction materials. Their being here is inconsistent. As you can see, no improvements seem to occur.
These 2 workers are the only ones among over 30 who continued working here to make a living. Ibrahim, Raed's colleague and cousin, is the only one who remained to work with him, doing some modest jobs, despite knowing very well that he's not the right person in the right place.
I have learned the Holy Quran by heart and studied at private schools. Then I pursued my study in Malaysia at East Asia University. My major was the Prophet's Hadiths. After that, I came back to Gaza. As you can see, I work in construction. We have no chance to work in related fields. The crossings are blocked, and there aren't any projects or development. There is nothing. There are approximately 35,000 unemployed graduates. Because of the blockade, this number has risen in light of the rapid increase in the number of graduates from the Palestinian and Arab universities. This means that there is a large number of graduates per year. More than 10,000 graduates join the previous number of the unemployed because of the lack of opportunities.
Hamza Hassan from the beach refugee camp has joined the army of the unemployed after 4 years of study in the English literature department at the Faculty of Arts. 2 years after graduation, he lives a conflict between dreaming of his certificate and looking for any job, even if it's not related to his field of study.
I graduated from university after 4 years of studying English literature. I and most of the other young people were surprised with the fact that there are no work opportunities. Even if one does not want to work in one's field of study, it is hopeless. Youth also suffer from boredom. Young people spend some time out, just like myself. We spend most of our time in having food, sleeping, and hanging out.
The Gaza Strip is surrounded by 7 crossings. The Rafah crossing is the only one connecting the Gaza Strip with an Arab country, Egypt. But the other 6 crossings are fully controlled by the Israeli occupation. And most of them are completely blocked most of the time. The only commercial crossing left partially open is the Kerem Shalom crossing. It is controlled by by the Israeli soldiers' mood.
The needs of the Gaza Strip exceed 800 trucks a day. Meanwhile, the Israeli occupation prevents more than 480 to 500 trucks from entering Gaza. These goods are very important for the development of the Palestinian economy and include all raw materials, machinery, and equipment required for the development of the economy or solving the problems of production lines. I am Majid Abdul Hafiz Abu Salim. I own a sewing factory that produces bags. This bag factory has stopped working for a long time because of the siege and the occupation. This is a leather sewing machine that we use in producing leather bags. All these machines as well. As you see, they are all off. There were 12 to 15 workers. However, after the blockade, the factory has stopped. All the workers have lost their jobs and spend their time at home or in hanging out. I used to work as a tailor. I haven't worked for almost 9 years now because of the siege, the blockade, and the Israeli restrictions. I have 6 daughters, 3 sons, and there's my wife and I. I cannot fulfill their needs. We're currently living by help and aid. Our life is very difficult, and the unemployment rate has become great. When school started, I didn't buy new bags, clothes, or anything for my kids because I was not ready to buy them their school needs and let them suffer hunger later. Thank God I'm not renting my house. May Allah help those who rent. I am not renting, though I suffer very much. الله يساعد المتأجرين دور يعني أنا داري مش متأجرها ووضعي كئيب جدا جدا أنا سجين وبعد ساكن بيت إيجار. I am a deported prisoner and I am renting a house. Currently my family lives by relief supplies and aid. There isn't a job opportunity and the situation is really difficult. As you see, I have 6 kids. Come in please. This is one of my 6 kids. Please come in. This is Muhammad. He is sick. What does he suffer from? He has convulsions, epilepsy, mental retardation, and speech difficulties. If he walks along the street, he wouldn't know where he is going. Every time he goes out by himself, I go bring him from a different place.
My sister-in-law has got rid of this closet, and I thought of removing my kids' clothes into it instead of being on the floor. All the kids' clothes are damaged. If my husband had a job with a monthly income of $200, not $400, it would be enough to pay for the owner of the house the first month, and the next month, we could buy a closet like most of the people. We could buy a bed for ourselves. We had a bed and a closet when we got married, but we sold them to afford the housing rent, because the house owners would kick us out. They're not tolerant, and they would ask for their money. The house does not have appropriate doors or windows, but we had no choice.
I tried to get a job. I worked as a taxi driver, but it wasn't helping because of the fuel crisis. And if you want to do something else, it must be at the expense of your health. I used to work in construction, but construction has stopped in the strip. The crossings are all blocked, and the situation is very bad. The construction materials are very expensive and rare. I am sick and can't do tiring work. In winter, water reaches up to this level. Even when I tried to make a hole in the wall to let the water out, some of the street water started flooding, and its level was higher than the kids' knees. We used to fill 6 or 7 buckets with water to get rid of it. People like winter, but I don't. I don't like it because it is tiring. This is our kitchen. The walls are cracked because of the rocket shelling during the war.
The Shaban's house is already cracked by poverty and also by the missiles of the 2 wars on Gaza, the 2008-2009 war and the late 2012 war. The Israeli rockets accurately hit targets other than the Shaban's house. They destroyed nearly 1,000 of a total of 4,000 industrial facilities. Many of the rest have completely stopped working due to the blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip since mid-2007.
This factory used to work in concrete in the Gaza Strip. It provided job opportunities to about 70 workers. During the pre-war period, we had 17 mixing vehicles and 7 concrete pumps. 10 of these vehicles were destroyed and only 7 remained. In spite of this, I want to bring this factory to life again to make a living. I want to contribute to the reconstruction of Gaza, but now there are small quantities of goods entering Gaza. More than 3,900 factories have stopped either completely or partly as a result of the prevention of raw materials and production requirements from coming in. Moreover, the Israeli occupation bombed many industrial facilities during the last two wars on the Strip. Most of the destroyed institutions started having problems with any production process. This made more than 45,000 workers, only in the field of production and industry, lose their jobs, which has led to an increase in unemployment.
With the siege tightening and factories systematically destroyed by the Israeli occupation, Gazans are tempted to break the siege through digging underground tunnels along the border with Egypt to bring in their daily needs of food and medications, as well as raw materials that may contribute to operating some industrial facilities in one way or another.
Many industrial institutions and laborers were working when some of the materials were allowed in through the tunnels. This softened the effects of the siege on the Strip. These tunnels, or the ground crossings as we call them, provided job opportunities to 35,000 workers in the construction sector and other industrial sectors through the entry of raw materials. My basic profession is sewing. As you know, sewing is not common now. We used to have orders from the north of Palestine. The crossings are blocked now, and there are no exchanges with Israel. In general, the sewing profession has stopped now, and I came to Rafah. In Rafah, there were opportunities and tunnels. Our area of concentration was construction materials, and especially gravel. Lately, transporting gravel has become difficult, so we started transporting goods. Merchants started providing us with goods through the tunnels. We rebuilt the factory. It used to give jobs to 70 employees. Now we are running one factory with one operational capacity. There used to be 70 people, but now there are only 30.
Tunnels became a lifeline for the residents of the Gaza Strip. The economy began to recover and unemployment rates were significantly reduced, either because of work in the tunnels or the supply of goods, especially with thousands of tons of cement, steel and gravel arriving daily. All of that led to dozens of large enterprises, including the reconstruction of Gaza after the Israeli destruction of thousands of houses and public facilities. But all of these improvements have stopped with the demolition of the tunnels. Gaza became besieged again, causing the unemployment rates to increase.
There is destruction in tunnels. Every day, a cement or steel tunnel is destroyed. The tunnel line requires at least 20 workers. It may be more, but there are not less than 20. The Egyptians said they have destroyed 350 tunnels. This is what has been destroyed. We don't know whether they have destroyed the rest or not. They have demolished 300 or 360 tunnels, each requiring 20 workers. This means that a total of about 6,000 workers are now unemployed. Relying on tunnels was not on the agenda of the Palestinians. This means bringing in food, clothes, and medication through the tunnels. But the phenomenon was forced on the Gazans, leaving them with no choice. Thus began the circle of providing jobs to the deprived in construction and production factories because of the Israeli restrictions. When Egyptian security takes an action in this regard, along with not allowing these materials to officially enter the strip, the problem of unemployment will become worse. I was doing well, and now I've got 30 workers. However, if tunnels remain blocked, I will reduce the number to half because there are no goods coming in. I recently divided the workers into two groups. Each works for 15 days. If the situation remains the same, I may lay off 15 workers, and I will cause the destruction of 15 families. I was working for a short period of time. Now I have stopped because there is no cement. I have 13 people in my house. Four of my sons are unemployed. They are all illiterate. No one else is employed. I have to take care of my daughters, my wife, and my daughters-in-law. The situation used to be different. There were job opportunities, and life went on. We used to work and make a living for the family. Life was better. Nowadays, the situation is different because there are no goods or cement, the crossings are blocked, and there is a siege imposed. I don't use the work equipment I have, and I have to afford the living expenses of 13 people.
Everybody is unemployed. There is no chance for construction workers, laborers, and contractors. They're all unemployed. Where will they find jobs? Even employees are complaining about the hard situation. If you intend to borrow some money from an employee, he will tell that his salary is hardly enough for him and his children. For those who receive salaries at the end of the month, they keep telling that it's not enough. An employee's salary is $400. Is it enough? The doctor with a certificate does not find work, as well as the engineer. Are there any projects or hospitals that provide work chances? Let new factories open to help workers find a chance. Is there electricity for factory work? If there were factories and construction projects, no one would need anyone else. We wouldn't need anything from the Israeli occupation, and no one would starve, because when a worker gets a chance, sometimes it's going to be much better than an employee's.
هنا كان في مشروع تطوير البحر وبالتالي
There was a project to develop the beach, thus expanding the street by the beach, but the work stopped. Look at this sidewalk. They are supposed to be paving another lane of the street. During the time I spent heading to the office or going home, I used to see many machines, engineers, and laborers working on the project. However, they aren't working anymore due to the lack of construction materials and fuel. This caused the company to stop the development of the street. In addition, many of the workers and engineers who used to work on the project stopped and became a part of the unemployed sector that already existed in the Gaza Strip.
The continuous closure of tunnels and the border crossings does not only exacerbate the high rates of unemployment, it also severely affects the performance of factories, the supply, the local market, with many essential products.
After stopping our work and having it ruined, you can see that we are hunting for work and making a wallet or repairing a bag, just like that. During the past 6 months, we noticed a slowdown in the sectors of clothes and sewing. That happened because of the lack of activation. You can add to this the productive and service sectors. They would be severely affected, and we would go back to the time, before 3 or 4 years ago, when there was great unemployment, a lack of goods and materials needed daily, and a growing crisis in many sectors, that would unfortunately worsen the humanitarian and social problems in the Gaza Strip. I was affected anyway. I cannot even fulfill the requirements of my customers or serve their interest. I pack gravel, but I can't do the same with cement. However, there is no cement, and when it is available, I can work with other workers. You can see that nobody works. Cars do not work, or employees either. Some workers come here seeking a chance at work, but I tell them there are no construction materials. If you can bring me any materials in the local market, I am ready to give you a chance at work. I've got the money and the intention. I am also in a hurry. I need to move to my new house. Today we ordered the bricks. The factory said that the bricks are not ready because there is no cement. I have been asking a blacksmith to build me a stair rod. The blacksmith agrees to make me one, but says we should agree on something first. He asks for extra money. When I ask about the reason, he says because there is no steel.
Freezing of small or large projects, the obstruction of industrial facilities, and the increase of the unemployment rate to more than 40% are all considered disasters that threaten to affect a wide range of the population of the Gaza Strip.
I and my sister-in-law were in the kitchen. My son was standing here, and my sister-in-law's sons were there. I was preparing milk for my son, and he was catching my clothes crying. The boiling pan slipped from my hand and burnt it. I should have gone to the hospital, but I couldn't afford it. I didn't have $1 to go to the hospital. I had a bacterium in the blood, and the doctor told me that this infection was caused by a polluted environment. I told him about the condition of our house, and during winter, my house becomes full of water. He said that was the reason. I recently had some analysis and found that I have problems in my chest. The doctor said I need medical treatment, and the prescription contained only two pills that cost $30. And I can't afford buying one. How would I buy those pills? The doctor gave it to me for free once because he knows about my situation. He also treats my patient's son and follows his case. He paid for the medication that time, but how would I afford paying for the rest? How can I buy two pills for $30?
The Palestinians are steadfast and patient people. They have been suffering, but they are aware that the main reason is the Zionist occupation. The occupation has been trying to suppress the Palestinians, but we say that they are patient, steadfast, and will continue to be so. They will keep fighting the occupier with their steadfastness and an honorable attitude opposing these conspiracies.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all around the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. Dear brothers and sisters, if you have been following this series of shows, we are trying to answer the doubts and misconceptions on the Islamic beliefs which are received usually in the form of questions from different questioners from around the world. The question of the day that has been asked by a respected questioner is concerning the holy shrines of the imams and the, let's say, the people belonging to the Ahlul Bayt and the household of the Prophet. It has been asked that why are the shrines of imams so luxurious, that is, in a, such as a mirror work, like millions of chenille linen, etc. Something like, for example, the palace of a king. So they have been beautified by different, let's say, beauties all around the, let's say, holy shrine. And we are saying that these imams are from the ordinary classes of the society. But the kind of the way, but the way that we are adorning their holy shrines does not want to prove such a reality. So, is really Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala satisfied with what we are doing with their holy shrines and make it that luxurious? For example, putting some gold and, let's say, beautiful chandeliers, as I said and referred to. And some, let's say, dharih for the tomb of the imam, and etc. So how would be the best answer for such a person to say that, okay, it really differs from the palace of a king?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I believe that we cannot compare the holy shrines of Ahlul Bayt alayhimu salatu wasalam to any other palace, yeah, because these palaces are the palace of the unjust rulers who want to oppress people and to want to cause trouble and injustice to the people.
Yeah,
we cannot at all compare it to the palaces of the rulers, because they are very luxurious. This palace is very luxurious, and lots of money has been spent on that, and so on and so forth. But talking about the holy shrine of Ahlul Bayt alayhimu salatu wasalam, you see that, first of all, these are from the donation for the most cases. I mean, generally speaking, these are from the donations of people.
Yep.
People, they want to spend their money, okay, yeah, for making the holy shrines of Ahlul Bayt and to beautify it to some extent, for example, using the beautiful lights, and sometimes the, for example, they use gold in the dome of Ahlul Bayt for making that, and they just want to give some beautification.
So the question is that why don't they spend such charity work on the people who are in need, and poor people or needy people?
Because these are, first of all, these are from Sha'air Allah. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that, وَمَنْ يُعَدَّمْ شَعَائِرَ اللَّهِ فَإِنَّهَا مِنْ تَقْوَى الْقُلُوبِ. This is in chapter Al-Hajj, verse number 32. If a person glorifies the signs of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, this is an indication of the, purity of hearts. These are from the Sha'airullah, and it wanted to, give, importance to the signs of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And first of all, you see that these are from Mawadda,
yeah,
from affections of Ahlul Bayt, because people, they love it. And of course, all Muslim denomination, whether Shia or Sunni, they believe in Hubbun Nabi.
Very true.
All of them, they love Noble Prophet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they have kind of love and affection with Noble Prophet.
Mm-hmm.
And this Hubbun Nabi and Ahl Baytihi, I believe that all Islamic denominations believe in that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And this Hub and Mawadda shows and indicate itself to the, in this way. They want to make it beautiful. Because mm-hmm. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I love Ahlul Bayt, because I feel kind of, relationship, heart relationship with them. I love them. And because of that, I want to make it very beautiful. I want to make it to some extent attractive. And these are not exaggeration.
Mm-hmm.
There is no, false in it. And you see that, what is the outcome of that?
Mm-hmm.
The outcome of that, you see how righteous people have been educated in the Holy Shrine. They attribute themselves to the Ahlul Bayt and to the school of Ahlul Bayt. And they go and help the other destitute people in the name of Ahlul Bayt, and they give charity. All of that, these are outcome of the, school of Ahlul Bayt, and how they wanted to educate themselves and to, for example, to be helpful for other people.
And this sort of beauty, as far as I know, is not necessarily just to make it that, let's say, glorious in the form that the palaces of the kings are, because